All right, so I think we'll just get started. I'll introduce myself first. I'm Kayvon Chargi. I am the visiting science journalist at KITP. I've been covering the neuroscience program for the past 3 weeks. This talk is entitled Sharing Your Unique Voice. I have two talks this week. This is the second of the two. Yesterday's talk focused on, so they have a common theme. The theme is basically how to use online media as an entry point for the public to connect with you and your research. Yesterday's talk focused on how photos and videos uploaded to media sharing sites can act as entry points to your research. Today's talk is going to focus on recording homemade videos that feature you on camera to communicate directly to the public. Hopefully it doesn't sound too scary. Okay, so the main idea behind this talk is communicating your unique voice to the public. So what do I mean by your unique voice? Well, this idea actually evolved out of a conversation I was having with James Fowler, who is a professor at UC San Diego, who studies social networks. And during our conversation, he made this great remark about what it means to be a scientist. And he says, "No one else in the world has ever thought of things the way you do. You have a unique voice, and the goal of the scientific enterprise is for you to communicate that unique voice and contribute to the social enterprise of science." Okay, so lucky for you, as a scientist in this time, you have a unique opportunity to contribute to the social enterprise of science and reach virtually millions of people online, because the powerful combination of video and new media platforms provides you with all the tools needed to communicate that unique voice. All right, so what are the tools that you need? Well, at a minimum, you can do this with a laptop, with a built-in web camera, and a built-in microphone. And then you can utilize free new media sharing platforms, which like a video sharing platform like YouTube, or if you're part of social network, you can use something like Facebook, which allows you to upload free videos. So let's take an example of how these tools are being used. So here is an example of sharing your perspective. So this video is from a new media campaign I launched in partnership with the National Science Foundation. It's called The Sizzle of Science. And basically, part of this campaign, we asked scientists to respond to the question, what is the sizzle of science? Very open-ended. In this video, astronomer Seth Shostak will give you his response.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, look, of all the things you could be interested in, science is certainly one of the most exciting. It's just plain exciting. Part of that has to do with the fact that it explains a lot of the world to you. Right? Every day you see things and you understand now how they work. And not only that, science has predictive capability. In other words, you can understand how something that hasn't been built will work. I can't think of any other form of human endeavor where you get that kind of power. It's just extremely interesting. And the other thing about it is that it's big picture. Whatever you know about science, beings thousands, millions of light years away, they will have the same science. They will know the same things. The same's not true of tax law, for example, or how to fix your washing machine. I mean, those are useful things. But on the other hand, they're very provincial. They're limited to this part of the universe at this time. Science is completely unbounded. It's really the big picture. So if you like thinking about big picture things, my gosh, what is there that's better than science?
So that was his response to the question. Hopefully give you perspective, not only about why science is interesting, but also about why he finds it interesting.
That was a question from you?
Yes, what's the question we just asked in general? What is the sizzle of science?
So you were there and asked him this question, and this is the result.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Was it edited and put together? Like, did he have a longish reply which was cut and pasted here?
Amazingly enough, he gave that response straight in one breath. That was it. The cuts that you saw are just basically jump cuts, and just where we just move the frame around just to make it more visually appealing. Mm. Let's take a look at another.
What did you call it? Jump cuts. Oh, jump cuts.
Yeah, jumps. Or the jumps around on the frame, right?
It looked as if it was further away and closer, but
Yes, that's part of the editing magic. let's take a look at another example. This is providing an explanation. This video is from Nobelprize.org, and they launched a series called Ask a Nobel Laureate. So there's a question that you'll hear, and a scientist will give a response to the question. And you might recognize the scientist in the video.
That's the question,
you're
not the scientist.
Hi, I'm Rebecca, and my question is, what would happen if we traveled over the speed of light?
Hi, Rebecca. So you asked what would happen if you could travel faster than the speed of light. You obviously know that Einstein told us that the speed of light was a limiting velocity. And what that means is that you can't travel faster than the speed of light. And the reason you can't is that it will take an infinite amount of energy to speed you up to the speed of light. So, we accelerate protons in these big accelerators and smash them together. The protons in these big accelerators, the enormous expenditure of energy, have been accelerating to almost the speed of light, 99.999999% of the speed of light. And that requires a lot of energy. But even to go from that velocity, which is very, very close to the speed of light, to the speed of light would require another infinite expenditure of energy. So you cannot be accelerated to the speed of light unless you have an infinite amount of energy to spend. The only thing that does travel at the speed of light are particles, which have no mass. And they always travel at the speed of light. Now, people have hypothesized that there might exist particles, which we've never seen, that travel faster than the speed of light. And imagining such objects immediately gets you into all sorts of problems, given everything else we know about how the universe works. Given such particles, you could communicate backward in time, and that leads to all sorts of causal inconsistencies. You could go back and do things in the past that would change the present. So most of those ideas are not taken very seriously, and it is, as far as we know, going to continue to be impossible to accelerate ordinary matter to velocities of light, not to speak of velocities faster than the speed of light.
All right. So, of course, everyone knows who that was, right? KITP Director David Gross, appearing in the video. All right, so you might come to the question.
And again, how was that film?
I didn't record that video, but I assume that's very simple. They have probably just one camera, and then there's a static shot, and there.
But somebody came to film it.
Yes, 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 yes. So let's see. So what should I say in my video? If you guys are thinking about making your own video, what are the possible things you could say? Well, actually, I mean, basically, you can just say anything about your science, that you, any perspective, any kind of inspirational idea, whatever it is that you want to communicate to a general audience. All right, so you might come to the conclusion right now that's saying, well, you know what, KVON outreach really isn't my thing, I don't have the time, but you actually do it every single day, just basically through the information that's on your lab homepage that describes basically what your science is about and what it is that you do. So the question is, how does the public get to your lab homepage? Well, if we think about it, the most direct route is probably reading a quote that appears in a newspaper or a magazine article that's featuring your research. And they come across your quote and they say, that this person sounds like a fascinating person. I would love to follow up with them or learn more about their research. I'm going to Google that name, and then we'll go back to that lab homepage. But the problem, there's a main problem with the homepage, which I know that all you scientists have, is that the homepage descriptions they're not very engaging for a general audience, and they don't really provide like any material for making an emotional connection that will really inspire the public to learn more about your science. So let's take an example. These are two organic chemists, professors working somewhere in the United States. Descriptions I just pulled off. So scientist one, their description on their page is this: our research interests lies in the area of development of new methodologies for organic transformations, target-oriented synthesis of biologically important natural compounds, and diversity-oriented synthesis of natural product-like molecules. Molecules thus built will be employed in the investigation of biologically significant processes. All right. Awesome. Let's take scientist two. Our research is directed toward the development of synthetic strategies and methods while pursuing the total synthesis of bioactive molecules. Areas of interest include asymmetric catalysis, organometallic transformations, heterocycle synthesis, Oompa-Loompa reactions, and cascade processes. Now, I took the whole organic chemistry series as an undergraduate. And I can understand most of this, but for a general audience, for someone from the public coming from your article, which features your research, to go into your homepage, this is almost just like indecipherable for them. But what is good, obviously, is for communicating your science to your peers, which is kind of like what the main purpose of this is. Like I said, it's not very engaging. And it also, if you think about it, it really gives no idea to who these scientists are. If I put two photos up here, you can almost exchange these descriptions for each of them. So in a sense, the scientist on that homepage is just an anonymous person, which is really what we don't want when it comes to forming memorable connections for people to connect with not only you, but also your research. So your descriptions almost act as an obstacle for doing that. So let's find a solution. So what would be a better thing to do? Okay, so perhaps you could provide on your homepage maybe a 90-second video that talks about an overview of your research. So here's an example of UC Riverside professor. She's an astronomer, Jillian Wilson, and she talks about her science in a very accessible way in this Meet the Faculty video. Let's take a look at it. Maybe they should have chosen a better freeze frame for the YouTube thumbnail, but let's see, look.
A galaxy cluster is exactly what it sounds like. It's a collection of galaxies close together in the sky that gravitationally bind together. And galaxy clusters have a long history in science and astronomy. They've actually been one of the major players over the years in understanding galaxy evolution and cosmology. These very distant galaxy clusters are particularly interesting because we don't know how galaxy clusters form. So we can study the physical processes in these baby clusters, if you will, and understand how they grow up to be the more massive, more evolved galaxy clusters that we see nearby at the present time. So clusters have been found at these distances before. What has not been done before is to find such a large sample of galaxy clusters. And also we're hoping that we'll find some of the most massive galaxy clusters that have ever been found at these epochs. So looking so far out in the universe is very exciting because we're able to test the conditions in the very early universe, which haven't necessarily been done with these extreme massive structures before. And we can kind of double check that our existing paradigm is correct and then perhaps even stretch it.
All right. So in that video, she communicates her science in a way that's both accessible to her peers and the public. And you also kind of get an idea about who she is as a person and what it is that she does. Most importantly, it's memorable. And compared to the text descriptions I just read you, the organic scientists, which one did you connect with more? The text descriptions or something that you just saw her on video? Probably the video? Yes? Okay. Yeah?
Probably learn more science from the other one.
Yeah. Okay.
Remember what it is.
What's that?
I don't remember who led it either.
You didn't remember what it either?
It's not fair to go organic chemistry versus astrophysics, by the way.
Well, this is all science.
I want to control the experiment.
I see your point, though. I understand. Anyways, okay, so let's...
Well, I guess your point is that, you know, even the chemistry once showed some molecules or something, you know, you'd get a sense of what they were really talking about. And so are you suggesting, though, that when we have a different page for our peers and for the public, like a separate, like, outreach page, which is more accessible, and then another one for peers, which has more of the details, or just through buttons?
Right. So let's see. So first of all, the idea is to integrate these things into your main page, right? That video description that we just saw would basically, I mean, it would work.
I see. It was on the main
page. On her homepage, and give a, you know, a general overview description that's, you know, like I said, both accessible for the public and also her peers. Maybe underneath this, you could put a more technical description about, like, really the details. But she did make remarks about saying, you know, what are the main questions that I'm looking at? Where is this going? Which, again, just give you that general idea. So if you're bouncing from this more general access point, such as an article or a magazine article, a news article, to going here, at least you can continue to access who the scientist is, what she's about, and maybe even dig deeper. Right, next connection from here. Might be, say, okay, I heard she talked about this topic and this topic. Maybe I'm going to go Wikipedia those terms, right, and learn a little bit more. On the next, the other idea you guys brought up was about saying this is, you know, kind of not fair comparison. Organic synthesis and astronomy is two different things. Okay, as a scientist and as a good communicator, it's your role to take these abstract ideas and then communicate them in a very general way. Right? Because even when you were learning the science, it wasn't communicated in a way that's very too dense to even go into. Right? You start out with these kind of generalities, and you build this picture, and you can go to the next step, and the next step, and the next step, and then you get to these Coulomb reactions and synthesis products, etc. So you can, basically what I'm trying to say is that you have the capability to build that bridge. Okay, other applications to think about. You don't just have to do an overview, just for the sake of communicating to the public. Maybe if you mentioned the point, Chris, yesterday, that you're saying I'm looking for new lab students. This could be a lab recruitment tool. I would assume that maybe some of the good qualities in the candidates you're looking for would be good communication skills. You could actually set the bar high by saying, here's a video of me communicating. I'm looking for lab students. And you expect them to have the same qualities. Also for conferences, I think this might be something good to do. Usually, if I'm looking for a conference program, I see very short, brief summaries of what the talk will be about. And usually the speaker might spend 10 or 15 minutes in the beginning of their talk, kind of addressing the more complex topics and orienting the audience to what those topics are about, making them accessible to them. Perhaps you could summarize those more complex ideas and maybe a short 1.5, 2 minute video that people can watch before coming to your talk, and then you can go into other more important ideas about your research findings. What would be some other applications that you guys think you would potentially use this for?
Well, that one you'd have to either assume that everybody at the talk had done that.
Done what?
Looked at that 1.5 to 2 minute thing, or you'd have to go over it in the talk.
Yeah. Yes, I see your point. If it was maybe too dense to talk about in the beginning of your talk, you could say, I have a further explanation of this that you could check out online that maybe some people saw before. But even integrating this into your program, I mean, you think the program format right now is maybe it's all this text-based thing that we're used to. Think about maybe what the future is going to bring, kind of hyperlinks into these programs, more of these rich media experiences, connect with me on video, see this before my talk. These might be natural routine things that people will be doing. So any other ideas about how you guys might use this? so let's...
Might be able to communicate with audiences like high school students.
Sure. Yes. That's a good idea.
Usual sort of standard outreach targets.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Imagine a journalist covers your research, and maybe they don't have space for a 2,000-word article. Maybe it's just 500 words, so they kind of maybe gleam over some topics that you'd like to maybe inform the public who read the article. So maybe if you're on their website or on a social media network where they have a fan page, which is basically just a profile page for organizations or businesses or institutions, you could say, hey, here's a video of me talking about something that this journalist didn't cover so much in depth, but I think it'd be really fascinating for you to look more into. And I'm going to explain it for you in 2 minutes or such.
Would a journalist typically be responsive to including that information in whatever they wrote?
Again, I mean, it doesn't have to appear in the article itself, but within social networks...
Well, I mean, a reference to the existence of...
Yes. Yes, and I mean, you're basically talking about inserting a hyperlink, which is something that's very obviously easy to do at the end of an article. Even a couple of days after the article comes out, you don't have to have it ready for that same day. You could
say. How do journalists feel about doing that?
I'm sure. I mean, basically, I'm sure every different magazine or news outlet handles it differently. But I'd feel that they'd be very receptive to it, especially when it's like saying I have a video of something that might be interesting. People love, I mean, these news outlets we were talking about yesterday, they don't always have access to capture video or rich media of the scientists who are doing their research. So by kind of offering that, it might be incentive not just to cover the research, but also kind of another bonus to the article. Good question.
There's one question about interest. I mean, we're assuming that there are lots of people out there who are really interested mm-hmm. in, you know, the sorts of things I'm doing, and therefore I should put in.
Yeah, that they really would like to get them interested in it.
Yeah, you know, which itself is kind of news to me. Yeah, if they read. And so my question is, you know, I can understand space, genetics, you know, certain things. You know, people are just naturally excited about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not really sure a lot of things that, let's say, condensed matter physics covers, which could be made exciting, I'm not saying it cannot,
mm-hmm.
but it takes some special effort
sure.
to say a crystal is an exciting object, etc. But then, I mean, does it have a place? I mean, is it, should we be spending all this time trying to make it accessible? I guess your answer is yes, but...
Yes, my answer is yes. But I think you have to think that, I mean, the reason it's not accessible is maybe because you haven't provided those perspectives
yeah.
that allow that kind of point of entry, right? So everyone, like, think, for example, like NASA, right? Everyone, like, if I ask anyone on the street, like, hey, what does NASA do? Like, you know, they send people to space, right? Because everyone has probably seen a space shuttle or a rocket, right? Maybe not enough people have seen condensed matter particle, right, which is a very abstract thing in itself, and probably doesn't even, I don't know if you can get even imaged. So it would rely on a little bit more kind of creative explaining on your part to say, here's an access point to this, because it's not just something that's very visually interesting. Or maybe, does that have any link to, like, for example, these everyday objects, right? Maybe like, you know, an iPhone. Is condensed matter physics part of communication, cellular communication?
It's like a transistor. You would start with the story of a transistor.
Right.
Yeah, iPhone.
Yeah, so you need these kind of concrete objects, right? And then to get into the more abstract ideas. So. All right, any other questions? Keep going. All right, so let's talk about two ways of capturing your video. So let's see, if you have a Mac, very easy built-in photo booth is an application where you can basically click on record. There's a video icon that comes up, and you can record your video, and it'll save it directly to your desktop, and that'll be ready for uploading on a place like YouTube or your website or wherever else you want to put it. That's using your webcam. Another example, if you guys are on Facebook, you have a Facebook profile, You can also directly record video onto Facebook and then post it on your profile. You can post it on other fan pages. You can spread it anywhere you like within that social network.
When you say directly on Facebook, you mean again through photo booth?
No, directly onto Facebook. So the media is going to live as part of your Facebook account. This media will be on your desktop. This will be on some server, wherever that's located. And I can show you how to just, I can click through this at the very end if you guys just want to see how that would work. Let's see. So if you really want to get your hands wet, these are two free video editing programs that are on your computers. This is on your Mac, iMovie, Windows Movie Maker. So don't ask me how to use these. I use a little bit more advanced editing software, but I'm sure they're very simple to use.
I use iMovie a lot.
Okay.
For videos, but not for this, but for travel.
Okay, and you can do cuts and
other things you want. Yeah, it's enormously flexible. Okay. You can add sound bits. Mm-hmm. Want to put music on it, or simply change the sound that was originally on on that bit to modify it because it's noisy or not very clear or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like so many Mac things. It's very flexible and very easy to use.
Awesome. So you are ahead of the curve then, making this happen. let's see. Okay, so things to consider when you're thinking about recording your video. Next camera action. Speak slowly and clearly. It's often when you first get in front of a video, you're talking very quickly, and most people can't understand you because you're moving your fast voice. So it's like it just begins to ramble on. So just make sure you slow down, keep and set a nice pace, and try and keep that pace. As we saw in the UC Riverside video, try to minimize your use of jargon. I'm sure she could have put in a lot more technical terms into how she was communicating what her research is about, but she kind of brought it back to a very accessible way that's open to just people who don't have that kind of complex language to work with. And try and limit your video to something that's less than 2 minutes, something that's kind of like very digestible chunks that people can watch, they can get that perspective, and then maybe they can move on, if you have more to say, they can move on to another video that you set up. But this kind of under 2 minute is kind of like a sweet spot. Again, so we saw examples of kind of using your of mostly kind of using external cameras in the videos I showed you. So if you aren't kind of really comfortable with an external camera or you're uncomfortable with that setup, try to work with people from your home institution to help you share your unique voice. They should have maybe some cameras. I'm thinking about kind of press officers or things like that. They should have access to those equipment, and even maybe to help you set up a nice shot to make you look pretty. And if you don't have anyone, you can always think about hiring me. Here's my email address, and I can help you to do that. So take home message.
How was the Riverside one done?
How was that done?
Was that just the computer camera, or was it?
That looked a little bit more crisp than a computer webcam. So I'm assuming, are you guys familiar with what a flip camera is? It's a very small flash-based camera. It's kind of like maybe about like four of these sizes, and you can basically kind of click and go like that. That's it's another very simple tool. It's about $100 to kind of get something like that. Of course, you can kind of move up bigger to those kind of handycams, which are kind of like these very kind of low-cost consumer models. But really, like, I mean, like in terms of cameras, sky's the limit in terms of kind of creating a nice production. But what you guys, I think, just for making for online, for posting online video, what you just really need is something very simple, basic. The quality, resolution of webcam would be more than enough to just basically get your voice across to an audience.
What about those little cameras on which you can take a video for about 4 minutes? It's usually just for photographs.
Like a point and shoot camera?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
is that better quality than this webcam?
It just depends on what type of camera you have. If you want, I mean, the good metric is to look at the resolution, the quality of pixels. So more pixels, it's kind of the general rule, the more pixels, general quality your video is going to be. Okay, so take home message. The web has evolved into an intimate space where people can make real connections through virtual interactions. So think about kind of utilizing the tools that we talked about to help communicate your science. Okay, so and you know, like all new technologies or ideas, there's obviously a rate at which you see these things spread. So when as you think about sharing your unique voice, using online video and new media platforms to the public, you might want to think about where you're going to fall on along this curve. So, anyways, all right, thank you. Do you guys have any questions or?
It's not completely clear to me that the video is a better way of getting these things across than just, you know, sort of taking the jargon out and just, you know, putting in the text. I mean, you can hyperlink and, you know, it seems like an equally flexible thing to do, right? Because, I mean, so you're comparing sort of very jargon-laden text with a very jargon-free video, but, I mean, it's not clear to me that, you know, it's the jargon that matters rather than the, you know, rather the media.
Sure. But what would you say is more engaging? Talking to someone in person or talking to someone kind of via telephone?
Also, there's a threshold that, you know, if you see words, even if they are like font and free of jargon, you have to cross some kind of threshold to start reading it. But if it is a video, you have a tendency to just click the play button.
I'm just not a video person.
My concern is a little bit like, okay, more you open up this possibility of interaction. But now imagine, suppose you put up a great video, mm-hmm. and people now start sending you email.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, that's what that worries me. I mean, I'm
Why would that worry you?
On archive, it's always more worrisome when you have concepts.
I think your earlier point is a very good one. People from time immemorial looked up at the skies and wondered, and you talked about astronomy, mm-hmm. getting to the audience. And we noticed that in our teachers' conferences. We have one on black holes, you get inundated.
Sure.
Interestingly, on string theory, that escaped me. But anyhow, it somehow has this appeal. You mentioned genetics, and I think we have an upcoming one on biophysics. And again, the response has been very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. We had one on high temperature superconductivity, which you would think was a tremendously interesting subject. It just fell flat. There may have been other reasons for it. I think there were, but it was also partly the subject. Mm-hmm. And we find it fascinating. And you would think possible application, gee, is much closer to people's lives than either of the other two.
Right.
But
yeah,
I think have the sex appeal somehow.
Well, I think, I mean, again, you have to make those right connections, right? If people can't really, I mean, this is what we're talking about, kind of the whole idea of this talk is basically people want memorable things to connect with, right? So if I see a text of someone or I see a video of someone, I'm probably going to connect more with that person than the text. So if you're saying, you know, this science topic is not you know, sexy, doesn't have a sex appeal, well, you need to connect things that are in the real world examples that people cannot just act, so they can access what those real ideas are about. And you can get them to thinking on that kind of, you know, abstract level. So it's a challenge, but it's, you know, there's...
I think one thing I found is it's very useful to start with a question. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about this media. This is something quite new
sure.
for me, but like in a talk to undergrads, which is kind of the level that, you know, the most public that I have done is an undergrad level. But something like, say, you know, how can a laser cool mm-hmm. atoms? And you know that, you know, laser cooling, that at once gets everyone's attention because
yeah.
they all think of laser as something hot, you zap things, and then I begin to tell them that you can cool it, and below any temperature you can ever imagine, and that gets people quite excited. But you're right, somehow some connection has to be made. And practicality somehow, even though we think should be important, doesn't seem to. I think because people see that as everyday stuff, they want to live in another sort of hyperspace. So that's why string theory is so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Or black holes.
Or black holes, right.
So what's like the most exciting thing about your research, would you say?
Well, this laser cooling is an example.
All right. So how do you make that accessible?
Bill Phillips' public lecture.
Yes.
No, but give me a perspective, you know, like laser cooling. All right. So what's connect laser cooling with something that, like, I still don't understand what laser cooling is, but maybe there's an example of the real world that you can bridge that for me. It's too big for me still.
Too big.
General public.
I guess laser cooling sort of dropped effect base, so that you could do, start off that way, but I mean.
Yeah.
Dropper effect is a radio jargon.
Why do you think we want to get to the general public?
Yes.
That wasn't clear.
Why is it important?
I can see why one would want to get those bugs.
Okay.
I see why one would want to interest graduate students or undergraduate students to go into graduate. Mm-hmm. And I would but I'm not quite. I didn't get why I want to get to the general public.
So first of all, I mean this talk is geared towards accessing the public, right? I'm just from a talk standpoint. But to answer your question, I mean, like, science is such a fundamental part of all our lives, you know? And it's really by having access to different perspectives that we can kind of really connect it in our everyday world. So why is that important? Well, I mean,
why is it important to me?
Why is it important to you?
Well, the long shot, you know, NIH get a lot of funding and NSF not much, and one of the reasons that people get sick and they know that it's very important to get their health, improve medical technology, and so on.
But that's true, but you're not going to, I happen to, talk to the NIH, so it's okay. But it doesn't strike me that one's going to make any major impact with this kind of communication thing.
So I would disagree with that. I think, basically, if you think about it, one conversation can be inspiring, right? So you can, in any moment this can happen, not just in a talk format or wherever in the world, but like you can come across one thing that's maybe taken you to the next level of your life. Does that make sense?
I kind of agree with you that, maybe one way to think about it is thinking, let's say, about a high school, right, or younger kids, and you want to sort of, and kind of, there are so many options today in the world in terms of jobs and careers they could choose, and of course they should explore widely, but here is another way to, gone are the days when people, when I was a kid, we would read a lot and our information was mainly coming from books. But now there are all these exciting ways people are getting information, and if we don't make our science as exciting at that level, they aren't going to, sort of get drawn into this particular funnel, so to say. So I think at some level we should be doing that for the younger generation to encourage them.
Again, I don't know. I mean, people are. I mean, who are you talking about?
What do you mean, who?
Well, you said that say superconductor thing was too mm-hmm. much. You want something on a much more public. Now, I've had to go and talk to a group of donors and try and get them to give money. Well, I got perfectly good motivation there to try and get right at the level
sure.
that they're interested in. And it's true, the public is funding research and is interested in what's going on, or some of the public is going on. But it's still not clear to me why do this. I mean, if you have a website, it is clear to me why to make your website as appealing as possible to undergraduate students and graduate mm-hmm. students. I mean, your name comes up and immediately everybody goes to the web and sees what is he published and what does he do and what this and whether the girls in the lab are good looking. I mean, you know, all of that happens, right? You know, I don't want some guy, you know, if I go to a party and somebody tells what I do, then about 15 people start asking me about their diseases and their itches and their this and their that and why I, you know, I had a third aunt with epilepsy and...
But isn't that exciting, all those connections you can make at a party?
That's your
you can be the center of attention.
No, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know, I understand. You want a hard incentive. Right? What's mine?
Right. I mean, I would like to see using these kinds of things not to try and go to a lower common denominator, but actually to get at our own population.
I don't think it's a lower common denominator. I mean, as a professional, you have to communicate in a way that's accessible.
Okay.
Right? Especially as a scientist, right?
Right.
You start overloading people with these kind of like more complex terms, it's like an immediate attention light switch. It's like, no, I'm like full blown here.
Sure.
I can't take it.
Sure.
And if you think about, I mean, just in general, like the kind of scientific literacy of, you know, improving that for our nation and how much of scientific literacy is actually linked to public policy, right? And laws are put into place, right? You know, certain bans on the science that can and cannot be done. What is and what isn't funded. These are really important things. These are things that have generational impact, right? So again, it goes back to that one conversation idea.
No,
sold yet? All right.
No, I mean, I'm convinced that, you know, that one has to try and catch the ear of congressmen.
Mm-hmm.
Or their aides, or things like that. I'm sure that people have to be involved and engaged. But at this level, putting, you know, a thing, unless it's within some kind of an organized framework of a university, for instance,
yes.
or an institute,
yes.
in which they say, here's who we are, and these are the people, and they're organizing in such a way that now the public is directed in some sort of a thing, and everybody yes. has an organized role in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, just putting it on your site, and that's it.
I agree, but I think if you go back to that, that UC Riverside video we saw, mm-hmm. not meeting the faculty.
That was an organized thing, wasn't it?
Exactly, it was an organized thing. And again, they might be part of this group right here, early adopters of using new media to communicate. And I would bet you, next 2 to 5 years, what you're gonna see is that larger groups are gonna be doing this organized communication using video, social networks, whatever else to get the word out.
And I think, in a way, what you're saying is it has to start at an individual level. Let's suppose my university decides mm-hmm. we are going to highlight some of the activities in the department or in departments on some organized website. It's much easier for them if these individual level things already exist. Mm-hmm. Then they can go and sample them and say, okay, these three look good. Pull them for the next level and so on.
Right.
So.
Right.
I think the other thing that I was thinking is, you know, most of us have not communicated at these levels. So it takes a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be a good sort of, you know, starting ground to think about it.
Yes.
So if you're suddenly, you know, not that I've ever been, like you said, you've been with donors and your people from the Congress, and so you already...
No, I've not been with people from
okay.
the Congress.
Okay, oh, at least with donors.
Okay,
so now if I was suddenly put in front of them, it's like I'm not sure where the words are.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have some video, I can sort of do a quick memory recall.
Sure.
And spout a few words at that moment.
Yeah.
So it can be a good lesson from that point of view.
And also, I mean, the other two videos I showed you, the Ask a Nobel Laureate, that was kind of a part of a bigger series, right?
But they have, that's a different issue, in a sense.
Well, it's... I guess the point I'm trying to communicate.
The second they get the Nobel Prize, they become celebrities. Mm-hmm. They then have on them,
mm-hmm.
they become spokesmen for science.
Sure. But even the campaign I showed you earlier about the sizzle of science, I imagine there's also going to be a lot more of those campaigns cropping up, again, because people have access to the bandwidth, they have access to the tools to generate those videos, and there's an interest for it, right? How many people watch videos on YouTube? A lot.
Really?
I watch videos on YouTube. You guys don't watch videos on YouTube? Never?
Millions of people do, though.
I mean, I'm really curious about how many views the median YouTube video gets. I mean, obviously, you know, there are a few that, you know, get tons and tons and tons.
Sure.
But you just put up a video.
My point about YouTube is not, like, you know, number of hits. It's that there's these free video sharing sites that are making this easy to do. You don't need any investment. You don't need to have a web host or a server that you're paying a monthly fee on. You can upload something free like YouTube. You record the video for free on your computer. You can get that out. You can reach global populations.
Well, one of the questions that you were asking, you know, what's really effective? And I think Nova and even the public lectures here, of which 150 people come for an evening from the general public to listen to support from science, are likely to be far more effective in generating interest in science in the general public than our individual videos.
Right. Well, I don't know about, I mean, so I actually, question, yes?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I mean, I'm not against outreach to the public. I think it's absolutely essential. But I think that, you know, there's also something called professionalism in the way the thing is put together,
yes,
the way it's done and everything.
Yes.
And you can't, you know, let's say you want to get to people, these things can be quite slipshod using these tools.
Yes.
They can come out looking and the guy can say, every second, and everything. Now, the university puts it into its head to push something and to get things together. If I go to talk to donors, if I'm sent to talk to donors, I'm prepared.
Yeah.
And if I talk once in one group and I use jargon, they absolutely point out to me what was jargon and how to stop using it the next time.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, there are people like you who have made your lives in doing this and doing it well, and because it's a competition. It's going on YouTube, but it has to be done well. What's
yes.
amazing about the National Geographic or about NOVA or about the Horizon or all of these programs is that they are really, really well done.
Yes.
And they're narrated usually by actors.
Yeah, but you don't need actors to do that.
I agree with you.
Okay.
You need a pro who put it together and who's doing it.
Yes, which is, like I said, if you don't have anyone to help you do this, all right. But I mean, I see your point.
I can tell you one thing that the NIH is not giving money to do.
Yeah.
They're not to do this.
Not yet. Not yet. But yeah, I mean, in addition to...
Can I raise one point about...
Yes, please go ahead.
Now, let's say there is this... You said there's a very... The public lectures are very successful. Mm-hmm. Would it make sense to invite, you know, a journalist at that event and then have them... take away some clips and make a professional short film.
That's something you could do. It depends on what you're, you know, let me...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, what's your question?
No, I was saying there were several such things come to mind, you know, which are more organized activities,
yes,
like that.
Yes.
There was another thing I participated in called Great Explanations,
mm-hmm,
and many people contributed to that. These were really short explanations of, like, what is a superconductor? What is emergence? And these were put together. Now, I had no idea what happened to that. I know I participated in it. They made me look at it and edit it. Now, maybe it exists on some website. But so your point would be to take wherever that website is and put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing from you, because YouTube is the link or the bridge to the public.
Well, that's I think that's what you got from yesterday's conversation,
yeah,
that we're talking about. And that's because, obviously, we, you know, point being yesterday was that YouTube, something like YouTube is search optimized, right? if you have a video on your website, people might not see that because the proper tags are not in place. And they can't stumble upon it also, right? Because we kind of went through those ideas. I think the bigger picture here is saying, you know, like at minimum, you can communicate ideas using the tools you have, right? Next level you want to achieve, you're saying, I want this more polished thing. You can find someone that's going to help you do this if you're interested, and they can put it together for you. Like I showed yesterday about how you cut together simple clips and images, right, that are part of your research into these news stories produced by National Geographic, Discovery News. What else did we talk about yesterday? Yeah, New Scientist. And I think you're going to see you have the opportunity to participate in more of these kind of productions, just based on the idea that people have access to developing a narrative from your research, and then having you kind of appear in it as an expert. So, which is something basically that I do from a professional side. I have my own video series. It's called Finding Your Science. It's just like it's like similar to like kind of this, you know, low budget Nova production where I talk to scientists, I gather their media assets, and I put a nice polished video together that's kind of accessible for a general audience.
Any idea who the audience is? Who is accessing?
You can look at the, let's see if this is online. You can look at the statistics on, YouTube, and it can show you if, you know, am I reaching global audiences here? Who's my age? Age side. Let's see.
So this is yours?
Yes. Let's do a trick.
It'll show you a number one and how many times.
Anyway, so actually, the metrics aren't popping up here, but anyways.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Said yeah. You guys want to see? You want to watch episode? You don't have to. It's 2 minutes. Yes, Dan.
Sure, it's 2 minutes. After all, it's on YouTube.
Sometimes the most crazy moments in science are when the preconceived ideas turn out to be wrong. In the 19th century, people were convinced that space was filled with ether. What happened was that this failure to discover the ether, which would have been in some sense an absolute, led us to this much more flexible idea about the way in which science should operate. And the answer, of course, is special relativity. Relativity is an incredibly powerful idea. It gave us the idea that we should think of time as being a fourth dimension and explains to us how we can understand all our observations without having any ether. So it could be the same thing with Higgs boson. Maybe that's the next ether. Here we are all telling ourselves we expect to find this unseen particle. Perhaps it would be much more healthy for the field if we just go, no, it doesn't exist. Something else gives masses to the elementary particles. One way of avoiding having a Higgs boson may be to postulate an additional dimension or more of space. So that comes back to, again, to the idea that space is not what we think it is, but it's actually a more complicated one. One of the main things we need to try to do with the LHC is look for this Higgs boson or whatever does its job. I personally feel it actually being much more exciting if experiments could prove that there is no Higgs boson, because that would prove that all of the ideas that these theorists have been working on for more than 40 years are garbage. That would be very exciting. But somehow I think I'm in a time.
So that's the example of, again, making your science accessible. That was about, you know, 2 minutes in length. It just required a few media assets to kind of like drive the story. And it was, you know, he seemed like he got his point across in a very clear way. So hopefully it came across clearly to you. So, okay.
And then you hope people will go to some of the other...
Yes, and this is what we talked about yesterday, about saying if you put your videos on YouTube, it does a great job of connecting related videos, right? And there's also this kind of stumble upon approach where it's like if they see one video about one science topic, whatever the relevant tags are, it's going to pop up another, you know, relevant topic, which is something that might not just, you know, happen naturally on if you're supposed to see videos only on your website. So this is why it's important to utilize these kind of video sharing sites. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Very much.